Kira, especially just from the inside rabbinic perspective. So immediately after Pesach, everybody wants very clear directions on where they can go shopping. And that's understandable, but it's also a little frustrating because it's difficult to give anyone a straight answer. And as you know, people don't like not getting straight answers, but it's difficult to give a very clear answer about this question for a lot of reasons. And some of them are practical, and some of them are halachic, and some of them are somewhere in between. So practically speaking, there's a lot of research that needs to be done, or a lot of investigation that needs to be done in terms of figuring out which stores have Jewish ownership and which stores don't. And that's separate from the question of just how much Jewish ownership makes a difference. And we're talking about majority Jewish ownership or partial Jewish ownership or controlling interest Jewish ownership. That's itself a whole discussion. But accepting that that's its own complexity, but there's clearly a certain amount of research that needs to be put into figuring out among the different stores and the different neighborhoods and among the chains that are throughout the country, where is there Jewish ownership and where there isn't. So that's its own level of investigation. But what either complicates things or helps things, or both, is the question of mechira. So many of these stores, and a good number of them, even if there is Jewish ownership, they still participate in some kind of a mechiras chametz. So the question is, in light of what we discussed about the topic before Pesach, how acceptable is a mechiras chametz in this context? If you have a store that sells chametz and that continues to do so over the course of Pesach, is it possible to say that any kind of a valid mechira took place? Now, sometimes we have these entirely kosher stores that shut down over Pesach or convert to only kosher Pesach products over the course of Pesach. So they will sell their chametz because they have chametz for the rest of the year. That's not going to magically all disappear before Pesach. So they'll sell their chametz, but that's not going to raise these same issues. That's similar to your selling your chametz. And in fact, it's actually preferable because we talked also about the question of motivation and justification. So certainly if your livelihood is tied up in your chametz, so then it's a much bigger need to find a way not to have to take on such a hefzis. So a store, that's a kosher store, that's selling their stock of chametz over the course of Pesach because they're going to be closed or kosher of Pesach during that week, so that there's no problem with. And if anything, it's perhaps better than the justification we have as individuals. But what we're talking about here is, what about a store that continues to be selling chametz over the course of Pesach? So that clearly raises a lot of issues, some very significant issues. So given those issues, which we'll detail in a moment, is it possible to say realistically that that still counts as any kind of a sale? So before, yeah?
Well, if the profits end up going to the person who bought the chametz, then it clearly was a sale.
Okay, so that's one point I want to address, that before getting into the problems, so there is a totally kosher v'yasher way to do it, which I think is what you're alluding to, that we'll just mention that first before getting into the problematic points, that there is a way that a Jew may be involved in the ownership of, let's say, a supermarket, and that supermarket may indeed be functioning over Pesach, but the Jew involved may actually be doing everything perfectly. So that does exist too. So what does that mean? What does that entail? So let's say you have a Jew who is a partner in a with non-Jewish partners. That would be the simplest kind of model. That he owns part of the supermarket together with non-Jews. So if he wants to do everything perfectly, what he could do is he could sell his portion of the supermarket for the course of Pesach. And during that time, he actually doesn't take profit at all from what's going on. And he sells it, as Natanael was indicating, in the full sense of the word, meaning that all of the profits for that time are going to the purchaser, are going to his non-Jewish partner. He's taking over everything. So that could theoretically be perfect, could not involve any questions at all. And just in terms of understanding the motivation for these things, and to give you a point of comparison, so there's two types, the two reasons why a Jewish person may want to keep his chametz business open over Pesach. And they're very different in motivation. One is because he wants to keep profiting from chametz over the course of Pesach. He doesn't want to lose that week of profits. That's a much more problematic kind of situation. A much more understandable situation is he'd be happy not to profit from chametz over Pesach. He's completely ready to be mochel on that. The problem is that the nature of the business is the kind that he just can't simply function the rest of the year if he's going to close over Pesach. So he doesn't have the ability to own a pathmark for the whole rest of the year if that pathmark is going to be closed down over Pesach. So that's a much more understandable motivation, that he's not looking to profit off of chametz. He's just looking to make a living the rest of the year. And that causes this complication for that week. And to give a comparison, which is a very parallel comparison, so the question of businesses that are open on Shabbos, and sometimes they have observant owners that also do some kind of sale of their business over the course of Shabbos and stay open on Shabbos. So the attitude Poskim have to that is very similar, in that the question is, why are they staying open on Shabbos? If they're staying open on Shabbos because they want to make money on that day too, so then that is not looked at as sympathetically. But if the idea is that they'd be happy to take off of Shabbos, but the nature of their business, let's say it's in a shopping mall, or let's say it's some kind of franchise, is such that if they would take off of Shabbos, they wouldn't be able to function the rest of the week either, because it needs to be available 7 days a week, or 6 days, depending on whatever it is. But there are certainly such businesses that are in a context that they can't exist all week long if they're not open on Shabbos. So then it's much more understandable that the owner wants to make an arrangement like that. And there, again, the parallel, the owner is happy not to take any profit from Shabbos. He's only doing this because it's necessary to keep his business functional at all, that it has a Shabbos opening. You know, to their credit, what's the Satmaron camera store? B&E? What's it called?
B&H.
Right, so I'm breaking an entry. So B&H, their website is even closed on Shabbos, which is quite impressive. It's its own sugya discussion. But apparently if you try to buy things on the website on Shabbos, you can't even do that. So if you have that kind of control over your business, so matovu manoim, but that's certainly more power to them. But most people who are doing business with a broader population, and especially if it's a major kind of franchise or business like that, may not have the flexibility to take off a day every week and still maintain their structure throughout the week. So there's a more sympathetic attitude towards arrangements for that purpose. So similarly here, when it comes to chametz, if this owner would be happy to forego the profits from Pesach, it's just that he won't be able to make a living the rest of the year if he closes for Pesach. So then what he could do is he could sell his interest for that week to a non-Jewish partner and really sell it in the full sense of the word and have all the profits go to him. And that would be totally 100%. It may be that he doesn't want to lose anything, and the deal might be that all the profits from Pesach go to the non-Jewish partner. But there's another week throughout the year when the non-Jewish partner sells it to him, so he gets 100% of the profits from some other week to kind of offset that. Okay, you know, it's not the end of the world, and there's really nothing wrong with that, but it's just, again, the idea is that he shouldn't be profiting from chametz on Pesach, so that is a legitimate and very above-board kind of way of doing things. And you may recall, a few years ago, maybe it was already 5-6 years ago, somebody discovered that the distributor of kind of all the beers in the New York City area was actually a non-observant Jew. And remember the story? It was Headlines had a podcast about it, remember? And that had tremendous implications people weren't aware of, because not that we're necessarily advocating beer drinking too much, but beer could actually be chametz gomer. And if it was owned by a Jew in that pre-distribution state, so then it would still be chametz shavua pesach, and these drinks are ending up in kosher stores and kosher restaurants and the like. So that was a major crisis that was discovered right before Pesach a few years ago. And there was somebody of Lubavitch persuasion, I forgot his name, but he staked out this guy, and he planted himself in his apartment lobby until he was able to approach him, and he convinced him to do a sale. And this guy ended up telling his story on the radio and on the headlines. It was a whole fascinating story. Maybe you can find it if you Google. And there, I believe also, it was done really in a very, once they got that far, they did it in a very above board way, that this guy, you know, never thought of it before, but the way it was presented to him, you know, take off a week and go to Florida and sell your business to, they found the highest ranking non-Jew in the business, and he ended up being in control for that week. And this owner, who wasn't otherwise religious, but it was presented to him in an appealing way, so he said, yeah, okay, I'll take that week off and not be connected to the business at all. And indeed, that was a very effective and appropriate way of doing it. So we're not talking about that. That if that's what happens, so then matova manoim, and that would not cast any aspersions at all, and there wouldn't be any shilas. So that's a part of an additional reason why it's complicated to give specific advice to people after Pesach, because the level of research you need to know, does the store have Jewish ownership? If it has Jewish ownership, did it have a mechira? If it had a mechira, what kind of mechira did it have? So maybe it had that kind of mechira we just described. That's perfect. No reason to question that at all. Again, it's more justified than what we do, because there it's really motivated by parnasa need, and it's more understandable than what we do as individuals. So if that mechira happened, so then no shilas whatsoever. But what if it's not like that? What if it was a mechira, but the owner continues to sell chametz out of his store, which clearly presents a lot of issues, both in the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. So a question about that?
I know we were trying to, like, connect it to the whole kvia situation.
Well, we'll get to it.
Okay.
No pun intended. But we're not there yet. So the question, first of all, what are the issues, right? There are a lot of clear issues. So clearly this is very far from ideal, both as far as the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. So one point to feel especially crucial to emphasize, that as far as the spirit of the law, I think we got far enough before Pesach when I said my vort about the spirit of the law, and that the reason I think that we embrace Mechiras Chametz from a spirit perspective also is that we're looking to keep ourselves from eating Chametz on Pesach. And if we take very seriously the idea that we have sold this Chametz to somebody else, it's their property for all intents and purposes, so then that will keep us away from eating Chametz on Pesach. If we're respectful of the sale as valid, and we're respectful of the prohibition of stealing, so then we're not going to take somebody else's Chametz, and that will keep us in a perfect place, hopefully, over the course of Pesach. And that requires, again, taking the sale very seriously, and not taking any liberties, and saying, well, it's probably mochel if I do this, I don't care if I do that, but taking a very serious attitude. Did I mention the truth of Reb Shlomo Kluger, about the guy who was in jail? So it's also quite interesting. So just to highlight that point before going back to the supermarkets. But it was actually almost relevant. So much to say about this. Okay, so let's try to say quickly that this is almost relevant this year, that the buyback of chametz after Pesach is itself its own fascinating sugya, and how exactly the buyback works. I don't know if we spoke about it at all, but it's got its own hours worth of material to talk about. But just very briefly, so the same rabbi who makes the sale before Pesach then ends up negotiating with the purchaser after Pesach and essentially buying back the chametz on behalf of his congregants. And it's very important for the seriousness of the sale to see that as serious also, that there has to be a real process of transfer in the other direction, where the original purchaser is now transferring it back in a new transaction to the Jew. So that has to be taken seriously too, if we believe this is a whole serious process. So it was actually a little complicated this year for those of us, which is, I think, 15,000 people, something like that, who sell through Rabbi Willig's arrangement, because, as you may have heard, Rabbi Willig is sitting shiva right now, so his attention was distracted right after Antif, and the purchaser, who was carefully selected, but he was in France for the end of Antif, on a program, no, he's on a France trip, so he had to arrange for a representative to handle the sale. So we almost had complexities on both sides in terms of this transaction. But Mike Sirba really did handle it on his own right before going to Sid Shiva. And this representative of the purchaser was considered to be adequate, even though it's not how they normally do things. But the tshuva of Shlomo Kluger is quite fascinating just in terms of how seriously they take this. So you'll recall, I think we explained, that the way it's basically done nowadays is with a down payment, that the purchaser gives a very token amount before Pesach, and the whole rest of it is a debt. So if he takes $1 million of chametz, he pays a quarter, 25 cents, before Pesach, and he owes $999,999.75. And after Pesach, he has the option of paying for it in full, or saying, I can't afford to pay for it, or I don't want to pay for it, so I'll transfer it back to you. So, Rav Shlomo Kluger discussed, there was a man who sold his chametz to a non-Jewish purchaser, who maybe wasn't of the highest character, and he ended up getting arrested over Chol Moed. And come the end of Pesach, this non-Jewish purchaser was not available. He was in jail. There was no way to negotiate with him. So the Jew thought, okay, but look, chametz is actually in my house, right? So I can just go and take it. And I also have a good claim to take it because he owes me and he's not paying, he's not around to pay. So I should be able to repossess this item that wasn't even paid for. So I have a good claim to be able to just go to my basement and open up the closets and take these bags of chametz that I had put there. But still, Rav Shlomo Kluger wrote that, no, that's not that's not acceptable. That's not the way you do it. That you have a actual transaction here. This chametz belongs to somebody else. You may have a very good claim that you should be able to seize it, but you can't act on your own in a vigilante system. You have to go to the Beis Din, let's say, and present the case in front of the Beis Din and say, this is property that somebody else bought but didn't pay for, and he's not paying for it now, and I would like to take it back because I'm owed the money and it's not coming. And then the Beis Din can evaluate the validity of your claim, and then maybe they'll say, okay, having looked at this, we now authorize you to take it. But to just take it on your own, because that's the only way you're going to get it, and they didn't pay you for it anyway, as credible and as justified as that may sound, that's still not something you can do. So that highlights again the importance of seeing a serious transaction here on both sides of it. Hi.
In that last example, wouldn't that make the sale retroactively no good?
No. That's crucial that you don't see it that way. Right? And this is a part of why it was so valuable to transition, let's say 200 years ago, to a collective sale organized by rabbis rather than the way they used to do it, as one individual selling to his neighbor, let's say. Because that's a disastrous mistake. No offense. Sounds like the nastiest thing to say to somebody's question. But that's a mistake many could understandably make, but it's a disastrous mistake. That the down payment, the rest of the payment, is converted to a debt. So they have to pay the debt, but it is not contingent. The sale is not contingent on that debt being paid. So there's a debt which is enforceable. You can go to a court and say, you owe me the money. But whether or not the money is paid, the sale is 100% valid and final at that moment of the Erech Pesach.
But in this case, aren't they going to the Beis Din and saying because he didn't pay the sale?
So we're saying,
void?
No, so we're not saying the sale is void.
So what's
saying,
their claim? But
we need some way to get repaid. So therefore, if I can't get my money, let me take the value of the money in order to offset
my
loss.
But it's a debt. So
right, so I'm taking this as a debt. I think also, I could be wrong about this, but I think in secular law, that's the way it works also, that even though Rabbi Willard was explaining this Erech Pesach to the purchaser, he said it was the opposite way, but I still think that this is the way it works in secular law, that let's say you buy a car, and you have a payment system, you're paying for a few years for this car, and then you stop paying. So they come and they repossess the car. I don't think that means that you never owned the car. I think that means that you owned the car as soon as you drove out of the lot with it. But you have a debt to pay the whole value. And if you're not paying the value, so then the law allows as a way to be compensated for not being paid that your only avenue to make up their loss is to repossess the item. But it doesn't mean that you never own the item. You own the item, you take a couch, you're paying on installments, you own that couch as soon as you walk out of the store. The fact that they can take it back if you're not paying, it's not because you retroactively never bought it. You bought it, but you're not paying your debt. So in order to compensate them for not getting paid, you take the couch instead, they can sell it to somebody else and get the money that you're not paying. But it doesn't mean that you didn't own the couch all that time. So whether that's true or not in secular law, it has to be true here. You have to assume that the sale is 100%, not contingent on anything. And two of the most likely contingencies would be either you want to make a contingent that he has to sell it back to you after Pesach, you can't do that, or you want to make a contingent that he has to pay the whole thing, that's the even worse problem. So that's for sure a worse problem because that contingency doesn't happen, so then that would retroactively invalidate the whole story. All right?
Stigmata is also there's plenty of situations where you can get into where this person becomes unable, like if they had a coma or something, that would be
a lot of things that could complicate things.
I'm curious, is there like a possibility of like you guys need like nine goyim and they start to have a business, and as a group they have a business where they buy the chametz, and then they only need like a majority vote to sell the
chametz? You certainly could do that, but it's hard enough to find one. So, that level of involvement is maybe someday this process will evolve to that kind of sophistication. But that's beyond where we're at right now. So, yeah.
I forgot my question.
All right, so we'll come back to it. So, let's say, so we have, what I was trying to emphasize here is so for the...
Oh, yes. Yeah. I remember my question. So, in the case of the car, if... You did own it the whole time, and they're repossessing it. Then don't they also have to give you back a significant amount of the money that you paid for?
No, because that's the nature of the law, and it's a whole different subject. It actually impacts Hilchos Rivus, so it has major ramifications for Hilchos Rivus. So if you want, ask that question again in 3 weeks when we read Parshas Bahar, and maybe we'll talk about it then. But we don't do that for now. So just to exit. Designate this as a one-day topic, so I'm going to try to see as much as we can in the next 9 minutes. So, basically, letter of the law, you have issues, but spirit of the law, I feel it's important to emphasize that what we said to the individual, that why Mechiras Chametz is within the spirit of the law, all that goes out the window in this discussion. For sure, the supermarket guy is very far from the spirit of the law that we described that. Let's acknowledge that up front. So that totally goes out the window. But what about letter of the law? So is it even valid from a letter of the law perspective? So why would you say it's not? So first of all, if he's going to sell property to customers that he already sold to somebody else, so doesn't that call into question the seriousness of the original sale? And on top of that, maybe it brings new problems, because maybe that is gezel. Very likely that would be gezel. And the concern for Gazel is what we said, again, on the spirit of the law perspective, that was making our individual Mechiras Chametz work. The fact that we are so scared to tamper with the Chametz because it belongs to someone else, so that's what's going to make it successful in keeping us away from the sin. So here, if you're selling it, it's very far from that. So, given those two major problems, and in addition, there's also a letter of the law problem that this guy has probably got some Jewish customers in his store, so he is on top of these issues. He's also certainly doing averos, so benefiting from chametz over the course of Pesach that he's selling, and also very likely being actual Jewish customers who will go there and buy this chametz and eat this chametz. So there's a ton of things wrong with this. Spirit of the law, letter of the law, and in terms of what it may impact on, there's a ton of problems. But given that we're bad on the spirit of the law, and given that there are some clear averos here, and that is for sure, nonetheless, is the sale valid for what it is? So this was a major machlokes haposkim. And we have to acknowledge, today we had commemorated the 30th yahrzeit of the Rav, so Rav Soloveitchik was among those who thought the sale was a complete joke. That a sale that doesn't have any impact on what's happening, and that the one who claims to have sold it is then going ahead and doing everything he was doing before, you can't call that any kind of a sale. That was the position of Rav Soloveitchik, it was the position probably of Rav Eliashiv, it was the position of Rav Belsky, who was one of the major poskim of the OU. So there were certainly many major poskim who took this attitude that the sale is completely meaningless. And therefore, that chametz would be chametz shav lav pesach. So certainly, if that's the attitude you would take, so then you would not be able to purchase chametz from these stores, even though there was ostensibly some mechira that took place, you wouldn't necessarily see this mechira as valid at all. Now, I should mention some gradations. We are going to have to dip in a little bit tomorrow, hopefully not too much. But I should mention some gradations here that really this question doesn't only apply to stores. You could say that it's a question for any non-observant person who does mechiras chametz. If somebody sells his chametz, but he's not personally observant, then he's going to be eating chametz over the course of Pesach. So that also could call into question the sincerity of this individual's sale. But it's significant that it's much less public. The fact that this isn't such a clear and known entity makes a big difference. And that actually is not even a matter of degree, it's absolute. It has significance of a very major nature. Because let's work backwards for a second. So why would anyone think the sale is good? Right? It seems indeed pretty problematic. So, we're going to run out of time, so I'll say quickly. Happens to be that despite the objections of all those great poskim we just mentioned, there were a number of great poskim who did accept the validity of the sale, among them most notably Rav Moshe Feinstein and a number of tshuvas, and also the Chalkis Yaakov for Yaakov Reish and others. So why would that be? So on the surface, we talked about this a little bit a few months ago, is that if your whole issue is that the behavior of the seller shows that he was never sincere in the sale, so that may not matter, because as we talked about, there is the notion of devarim shebalev einam devarim, that when you have a transaction between two people, so the terms of the transaction have to be limited to what's actually said out loud. And if I'm not sincere when I sell something, but I don't say anything about that, so then it's not fair that that should impact the rights of the purchaser. If I sell you my car, and you pay for it, and we sign a contract, and then I come back a week later and say, I was just kidding, I wasn't sincere, so I'm taking my car back. So the buyer will say, well, I don't care whether you were sincere. We dealt with this in terms of explicit negotiations, and whatever we actually said out loud and wrote down on paper, that's what's meaningful. And what you were thinking, Dvarim Shebalev, Veinam Dvarim. So, theoretically, that really should be a rock-solid principle, that no action that a seller does after he sells something should be able to retroactively invalidate his sale. not fair to the purchaser. So why would this be any different? So the argument that it's different is that this is not simple varim shebelev. This is what you might call varim shebelev ubelev kol adam, that this is something which is known to anyone. Or you might call it an anan sadi, that the whole world is aware of this. And especially, if you have a history, this door has always been open over the course of Pesach. And he's actually advertising, right? He has a business. People know that the store is going to be open over the course of Pesach. So it's not realistic to say, well, the purchaser didn't know all that stuff. This is all way out there in the open. So that's why the Machmirim take the position that they do, that to say this is simple Dvarim Shevalev, when it's overt and public and advertised that he's going to continue using this Chametz for commerce over the course of Pesach, that's not simple Dvarim Shevalev. So, yes, you could raise the same question by any non-observant Jew who sells his Chametz, but there you could say, all right, that's not necessarily so known to the purchaser, and maybe we have faith that he'll do tshuva at any moment. And why should we assume that he's going to sin even if he has in the past? But here, when you have a business that's public and advertised and it's out there in the open, so it's a significant difference, and maybe you would call that Barim Shebelev Kol Adam and an Anan Tzadi, and that should disqualify the sale. Just to mention one major mucker, and we'll have to spill it over a little bit tomorrow, we'll dive in a second, there's a Gemara's Mishnah Nedarim, where the Mishnah talks about the case of Maisa Baschor, Beschorim. Did we talk about this at all? Right, just quickly, so the Mishnah talks about a situation where there was somebody who wanted to make a wedding, his son was getting married, and he wanted to invite his own father, the grandfather of the chassan, but the grandfather had taken a neder not to get hana from the son, from the father, the middle generation here. So the father wants to invite the grandfather, even though the grandfather took a neder not to benefit from him. So he said to his neighbor, he said, okay, I'm giving you the wedding hall and the meal as a gift. And it's yours, and I want you to invite my father to the wedding. So the neighbor said, okay, thank you for this wedding hall. I'm right now dedicating it to the Beis HaMikdash. And the first guy said, no, that's not the point. The point is that you're supposed to invite my father. And the neighbor said, yeah, I understood exactly the point. The point is you're trying to work around this nether and play a game and use me as the tool for this, so I'm not playing along. And the Gemara says about that, that kol matana she'eno yochel akdisho, any matana you give somebody and he's not able to dedicate it to the Beis HaMikdash is not a matana. And the Gemara there also says that sofo hochicho atchilaso, that what he did afterwards ends up showing you what he meant to begin with. So on the surface, this is an example of a transaction that is not valid because it's just essentially an overt fake out. So the question is that relevant here? Is it relevant to Mechiras Chametz in general? I'm afraid we'll have to push our questions because we're going to have that in a second. But is that relevant to Mechiras Chametz in general, or is it especially relevant to the store situation? So many poskim consider this, and they pointed out that this is not necessarily comparable to our situations because it's very extreme. You have everything in place there. You have the guy saying explicitly what it is he wants to do with it. You have that obvious from his actions, and there's no benefit whatsoever to the recipient. So when you have all those parts together, so then it's really nothing. And then we say, so that this, his actions in the end show what he meant the whole time. And the Rishonim say that this idea that if you can't be makdish it, it's nothing. It's not necessarily about hektish. It could be there may be a gift where for whatever reason you can't be makdish it. But here, there's nothing he could do with it. He got no benefit from it whatsoever. So this was just a way of saying that there's no use he could have at all. So if there's no use and it's overt and explicit why you're doing this, so then all of that together, that's not going to be good. But tweak any of those parts, it may not necessarily be the same. So part of this whole machlokas is, do you see the sale of the supermarket like a maisa by Esharon? It's basically completely fake without any redeeming qualities. Or is there a difference here? So that's a big part of the machlokas. So again, I do want to get to Gittin, so we won't take too much time out tomorrow, but we'll just take a few minutes just to wrap this up. Who would like...